Hello, Food Chain. This is Sharon Chittone, and I'm a food tech junkie and innovation nerd who loves a good story. This podcast combines all of my favorite vices into a deep dive about the problems our food system faces and the visionary people working on solutions. Today, we talk to someone who has turned his childhood passions into a groundbreaking career. Hailing from rural Ecuador, Martin Zurilla has always been captivated by the world of insects and the importance of environmental conservation. Today, he serves as the Chief Technology Officer of Nutrition Technologies, a rapidly scaling company that is revolutionizing the way we think about agriculture, climate, and environmental sustainability, all through the lens of insects. Are you ready for this exciting conversation? I am, so here we go. Hi, Martin. How are you?
Hi, I'm good. Thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure. So there's a lot I want to unpack with you today. But before we do that, could you briefly introduce your work to our listeners? I'm sure many of them are familiar with it. But can you tell us also how you got started and what led you to do what you're doing today?
Sure. Yeah. So my background, where I'm coming from, is I am an entomologist by training. I'm one of these kind of like, since I was 6 years old, really deeply passionate about insects. You find that with entomologists, right? We're kind of kids that never grew out of the insect collecting habit. And that was because I grew up in Ecuador in South America to American parents, and I had these really amazing surroundings. I lived in a tropical forested area of Ecuador that had a lot of cloud forest. And that's just it's an ecosystem's really rich in insects. So they were all around me. My family worked in environmental activism, protecting the forests of that region. So I come to the insect industry from a background of both the insects, then also kind of the environmental credentials that insects have. I joined the company I work for now is Nutrition Technologies. I joined it actually in Vietnam. I was visiting my brother. I heard about this startup, and I met, at the time, it was just the co-founders and a couple staff working out of a small lab at Nong Lam University. I was a little skeptical at first, to be honest, of insect farming. I really didn't think it was a great idea. But I saw the system and I saw the insect they were using, and I was just sold. It all kind of made sense once you saw the production system. I've been doing research and development, technology, intellectual property work with them ever since. And we've scaled the company now so we're now about 200 staff operating out of Malaysia and Singapore with a commercial scale facility. So it's been a wild ride.
Well, it has been. Can you tell us a little bit about your solution? What does it aim to do?
Yeah, so black soldier flies, if you're not familiar with them, are these really neat little bugs. They're originally from South America, and they're a non-pest species that are really good at breaking down actively decomposing organic matter, right? Mm-hmm. So they work in concert with microbes to break down larger molecules into smaller ones and take them up into their digestive system. They do that in a very efficient, low energy, low space kind of system. So our company, Nutrition Technologies, we ferment all of the feedstocks that we use. We use factory grade food waste. So this is kind of big. Beverage and food manufacturing companies generate things like when you make instant coffee, the waste grounds or brewer spent grain from beer that would otherwise end up in landfills. We take those at specific quantities and combine them using feed formulation and a quite intensive testing process, and then feed those to our larvae. Those larvae grow, consume the organic matter in just about 7 to 10 days, they reach full size. You harvest them, and then the larvae themselves are processed into a protein powder that goes into pet food and aqua feed as a sustainable alternative to some of the existing products like fish meal. But there's another product too, which is the frass, which is actually equally important. So frass is insect poo or insect manure. It's a really interesting, very concentrated organic fertilizer. And we've been doing a lot with that. So we compost the frass. We make some amendments to it with black soldier fly chitin, which is a molecule that upregulates plant immune system. And we add microbial inoculants that we found in the black soldier fly microbiome to create biofertilizers that combat common plant pathogens. There's a lot in there, sorry.
There's a lot to unpack. So let's start from the sort of the bigger picture and let's make our way to the day-to-day. So you obviously, with your background and also, I guess, your calling, your need to preserve, why is a solution like yours so important in agriculture and sustainability?
Yeah, it's a good one. So I think a lot of the reason that we do what we do and why we think it will be like insect agriculture in general will become over time, especially an integral part of human food systems, is there are a lot of problems around animal feed. And it's funny because like people don't think about animal feed that much. Like in your day to day, it doesn't really come up, right? But more than 60% of arable land, cultivated land, is dedicated to animal feed between pasture and products like soybean and corn that we primarily grow to feed to animals. And yeah, that's just a crazy thing. That's a fundamentally an enormous, in my view, an enormous misuse of, you know, if you think about that land area, that there's all the impacts of farming and tillage and industrial farming, but there's also like what would otherwise be on that land, right? Which is usually intact ecosystems in places like Brazil, you know, very biodiverse ecosystems. And then like, that's not even the crazy part, right? Because in animal feed, in aquaculture, but actually in swine food and a lot of other animal feed contexts, even a little bit in pet, we use fish meal, right? And fish meal is wild fish, right? And we catch in a year something around 20 million metric tons of wild fish. And we turn that into fish meal to feed to farmed fish, right? And it, generally speaking, it takes more wild fish to farm a farmed fish, like kilo to kilo basis. And again, it's totally insane. Like these wild fish, they're called pelagic fish. They're perfectly edible. If they had stayed in the ocean, you can make all kinds of arguments about like, is the fishery sustainable or, you know, and like they've done a lot of good work on like the pelagic fisheries in some countries. But fundamentally to me, it's like you're taking 20 million metric tons of wild fish out of the ocean and into human food supply chains. Like, again, what would happen to them if we kind of left those 20 million metric tons of fish in the ocean, right? We haven't done that, you know, since probably the 1950s. So that whole ocean food system, all those animals that rely on pelagic fish, they're a huge engine of ocean health. And we just don't know what our oceans would look like if we left those fish in the ocean. So yeah, that fundamental need, the need to have something more logical, a flow of kind of mass and energy, utilization of resource into animal feed supply chains is what motivates us, right? And we come from a perspective also, you know, especially being based in Asia, that animal protein, like it or not, the consumption of animal protein is increasing. As countries move out of poverty and into the middle class, there are people who prefer to eat animal protein. That need is not going away anytime soon, especially in places like Asia. And the consumption of certain animal proteins like aquaculture can actually be very sustainable if they're done very well. But like aquaculture, for example, it's kind of a one-to-one feed conversion rate for fish, which is really, really cool, much better than most other animals. And you can do a lot with like water quality, and you can do a lot with trophic levels in aquaculture. It's a really attractive kind of long-term thing that humanity can do to feed itself, very healthy. But A huge problem is the feed, right? You just can't ignore that, that problem. So we're trying to fix that, and we're trying to approach it in a few different ways.
Wow. In this podcast, we talk a lot about the need for not just solutions, but for collaborative, systemic approaches to solve some of the biggest challenges that we are facing today. What do you think some of these actions might look like for the sector you're in?
Yeah, I think when we look at the food supply chain, we see a lot of really positive movement, right? And I think a lot of pretty fast, pretty remarkable success can come from connecting different parts of it. It's just one of these things, like animal feed, again, it's just something that doesn't come up. But if it were a little bit more, or there's certain players in the space that have a huge influence on what we eat and how we eat it. Grocery stores in particular have a very powerful influence over what they present to customers and how they interact and educate customers on. If animal feed increasingly becomes part of that story, then I think we can very quickly move the needle on this issue, right? The alternatives that are out there, like insect production, are actually very scalable. They're also kind of just the natural way that animals eat, right? So there are kind of networks of benefit. And it's one of the reasons we like the insect production space, right? It's not a single approach. You don't reduce the problem down into one thing. You're trying to provide a systemic solution, right? So food waste is a major issue. You know, these insect production facilities take in food waste in ways that are more robust of a business model than say composting that has to be subsidized by the state and can only be done by wealthy countries. So it's trying to provide those waste solutions, those feed solutions, and then, you know, kind of integrating that food supply chain so the different components talk to each other and say, hey, this is valuable. This is something that we want. That's really important. Because at the end of the day, the actors in this food system are often pretty retrenched in their ways, pretty unwilling to move, and pretty used to the fact that most people aren't really paying attention to things like animal feed. A lot of potential clients that we'll speak to will say, I'm not being asked at all to make a change. And I think that's definitely something that, you know, we can do better, and we have a lot of partnerships that are really leaning in the right way. And as our sector grows, I think the awareness of the issues grow. And we're really starting to approach, I think, a sea change in this area.
Which is fantastic. And another issue is, I would say, regen ag versus intensive agriculture, which you provide a solution for that as well. So can you first tell us a little bit about why one is better than the other? And how are you helping the regenerative farming through your FRAS?
Yeah, I mean, there's kind of a common line of thinking here where we think about our food system and we think about our agriculture. For us, when we think about agriculture, again, you know, we come from this place very much of trying to think very deeply and carefully about how intact ecosystems function, right? Because our role, the way we see it, is to provide a function within our society that already exists in a natural functioning ecosystems, right? Decomposers in forests, grasslands, freshwater environments. Decomposers are often, there's always insects involved. Like find any natural habitat that does not involve insects for decomposition. I would be shocked. Insects are always involved. Invertebrates are always involved. So in these ecosystems, decomposers recycle nutrients and make sure that waste doesn't accumulate in toxic ways and brings nutrients back up into other trophic levels, make it available to those creatures. And that allows those ecosystems to persist over time for millions of years, right? Time scales that we can only barely kind of conceptualize. So we see ourselves as trying to provide that role of decomposition, of not breaking things down the way people think of decomposition, but of building things from organic matter, right? Decomposition is the transformation of mass into forms of mass. So in that way, when we think about agriculture, we're trying to provide solutions that integrate well into agriculture and mirror the same sort of interactions we see in ecology, right? In a grassland, a forest, a freshwater ecosystem. So where that leaves us is in the agriculture space, we work a lot with frass, right? So again, frass is insect manure. And thinking big picture about frass, it is ubiquitous in natural environment, right? You go to any forest, you lift up the leaf litter, you see all these little round pebbles of things. And, you know, there are insects called detritivores that break down that leaf litter into soil organic matter that the plants can take up. Plants evolved with that, right? Plants are very used to receiving a lot of their nutrients via frass. They have receptors in plant cell walls that pick up, detect these molecules called chitin, which upregulate their plant response to potential pests. And they're getting some of that information from frass. Plants actually get a lot of information from frass. So our approach to frass is to say frass is not a new product, right? Frass to plants, frass has always been around. What's weird is that frass hasn't been used in agriculture, right? Meaning that a lot of plants are grown in these very sterilized environments, especially in nurseries, and they don't have access to these kind of very nutrient and microbe-rich materials that they might have evolved with. So we're trying to apply frass products in agricultural systems to improve the outcomes for farmers, but also to improve soil health by reintroducing frass to agriculture.
Which I mean, soil health is another huge issue that is often overlooked, and it's central whether we talk about desertification or nutrient density. And there are different ways and frameworks to farm land. Some can improve and others can destroy our soil, right? So today, most of the approaches are intensive, the opposite of restorative. But how are you guys trying to advocate for different and sustainable methodologies when it comes to farming per se?
I think, like you mentioned, right, like with soil health, there's often a very fine line between kind of adding or maintaining the value of a healthy soil versus draining resources. And we did this large study a few years ago that really shifted our thinking on this, where we tried different frass products in an agricultural greenhouse system with a university partner. And one of the interesting things we found was if we used our standard frass product at the time, which was an uncomposted kind of just fresh out of the factory product, we applied it to the farm. That product, and we had three controls with different fertilizers. They all decreased soil organic matter, but we had one version of the frass product that was fully composted, and those significantly increased soil organic matter. So something like a 4% drop versus a 12% increase with the composted version. And that's kind of basic soil science and basic agronomy. But it really reinforced to us that in order to make an impact, especially over the large acreage that our products are applied to, thinking very carefully about what it does to organic matter and soil carbon can actually have a really big impact. So we've implemented a composting process for our product. And we've also advocated across our industry that everyone do the same. So we want to move the needle. So the standard product out there when you purchase black soldier fly frass or other insect frass is a composted frass, because you know it starts off kind of semi-composted. We want to make sure it gets all the way there. And then we also want to start thinking deeply about like, okay, how can this be used in ways that facilitate good land use, right? which is really context dependent, right? Like we're in Malaysia where you have weathered tropical ferrous soils, right? These are like clay, red clay environment, super low organic matter. So the farming practices that will work in Malaysia are just absolutely not the ones that work in North America. And what we're finding is there are really limited resources for farmers who are trying to figure out kind of, especially like from a science perspective, what is the best approach in their climate and geography. So we've joined the Alliance for Soil Health in part to pursue that type of research to make sure good science is in the hands of the farmers who are implementing the strong practices around regenerative agriculture.
Which is amazing. And that's another topic that we talk about a lot here. We have a lot of these great solutions like yours and a lot of the same global problems, but we need to adapt them to local context because the world is very different and there's not a one-size-fits-all approach. There's no one tool, right? We have to use everything that we have at our disposal, which at times is very, very different to do because people are very polarized these days. So do you notice that in your day-to-day, the people you speak to, do you notice this sort of like there is just one approach mentality or polarization, or are you finding more and more people open to different solutions?
Good one. I think I encounter plenty of both. I've always struggled in my kind of career in life against the reductionist, right? I'm a scientist, but I'm a scientist who resisted specialization and kind of a reductionist approach to science. And in doing so, I've been very successful in the work that I've done, but reductionism is everywhere in our society and specialization is everywhere. And I think you have, unfortunately, a very heavy lean towards kind of simple stories around solutions that exclude other options. And my departure point for this is always like, I think there are really good models for how to build sustainable food systems out there, right? And again, like, those models, in my mind, often tend to be these ecological systems that kind of figured it out far before we started creating human resource systems. And those systems are, by definition, highly complex, right? Highly complex. And if you, like, coming from kind of biology and ecology, like if you study ecology in the sense of like the study of ecosystems on areas of land over time, you know, it's really interesting to speak to ecologists. It's really quite fun because ecologists always have this patience and ability to grapple with complexity that a lot of other disciplines don't have. It's very difficult to work in ecology if you don't constantly think about context dependence and don't question every possible version of how things could be, because that's the world around us, right? Life on Earth is just highly, highly complex and context dependent. And every time you think there's a rule, there's an exception. And I think that really intimidates people, you know, that really, people really don't like the, I think what it comes down to is the fear of the unknown, right? Whenever you have complexity, it means you don't understand it fully, which means that you have parts that you're unfamiliar with. And that triggers a lot of negative emotions in people. But I think when you approach problems in the food system and in society in general, approaching with like a patience for complexity and the ability to grapple with complexity is just very valuable, right?
Yeah.
Because ultimately that's what it's going to take. It's definitely not going to take a silver bullet, a single solution. It's going to take this super complex, multi-layered thing where some things work in some places and some things, you start with some things and then you'll have to transition to others over time. And that's the way it works. And I think we just have to embrace that.
I couldn't agree with you more. Also between, let's call it fear or stubbornness by the old-time farmers to keep things as is, not use technology or innovation, as well as we all know that agriculture is one of the least digitized sectors, to continuing with this linear and extractive way of doing things, not looking holistically and locally at what it is that we might need. We are always stuck in something that we have proof that it doesn't work. It's maddening. But anyway, so from what I understand, everything you do is natural. You don't use chemicals. You look to mimic what happens in nature. So let's say if I start using your biofertilizers or your solution, what's the time frame for either my soil to regenerate or see results with your, with your solution? What's the impact and how fast can I see something happen?
Yeah, well, I think it depends really with which product you're using, and also kind of like all the variables of your context. There's a good product range out. Our issue on the feed side is we don't produce a finished product, right? So we sell a feed ingredient that then goes into a range of products where people will combine it with others. So the finished product we don't have a whole lot of control over. But there are a number of really nice companies in the feed space and in the pet food space that are producing some really spectacular products. So in the aquaculture space, usually it's like you would see results within a production cycle, which really depends on kind of the fish species. But like for shrimp, for example, you'll see it impacting growth and survival rate of shrimp. So shrimp that are fed insect protein across a range of studies have been shown to survive pathogen challenges much more successfully than fed conventional protein. So again, you're just kind of providing this material. Black soldier fly protein in particular is really high in antimicrobial peptides. So it strengthens their immune system and their responsiveness to disease. On the pet food side, which is more kind of what people might be starting to be familiar with, it's really relatively big in Europe now and picking up around the world, is to feed pets insect protein. And there's really good reasons to do that. And actually, people will see really positive responses quite quickly. So on a fundamental level, there's kind of you can buy insect ingredients due to its sustainability, right? Like we feed an egregious amount of good quality meat to dogs and cats that we really shouldn't be. Insect protein provides an alternative to that. Also keeping in mind that these are carnivores that do need animal protein. But on the other end too, a lot of pet owners are buying insect protein products because they're actually kind of hypoallergenic. There's kind of the science of that term is a little fraught, but generally speaking, insect products can improve pet sensitivities to existing food. And one of the reasons for that is like dogs and cats are basically fed the same meals their whole life, right? There aren't that many options. It's like beef or chicken. And because of that, like just overwhelmingly kind of overuse of certain proteins, they become sensitive to the feed. So they'll develop skin issues often. Insect protein is hypoallergenic just in the sense that it's new. It's a protein that dogs and cats actually evolved to eat. So it's like dogs, for example, they have chitin enzymes in their gut to help break down insect protein. So it's their natural food. Like in the wild, the ancestors of dogs would have eaten insects as part of their natural diets. But by reintroducing it to dogs, you get this novel protein that they haven't encountered before, allowing them to take a break from these overused ingredients. And you should be able to see within a month to two improvements in like dog, like coat color, glossiness, firmness, but also like the stool quality of the dogs tend to improve. So yeah, again, kind of a network of benefits. You've got the sustainability, you're giving your dog a little bit of a break, some novelty, and hopefully you get a nice outcome as far as the dog health.
Yes, and I can attest to that. I mean, my dogs eat all the worms in the gardens.
Yeah.
You guys are doing so many interesting things. What does your day look like?
So I work out of Singapore, and I have a small team in Singapore. We have a couple of people working in molecular biology embedded within university laboratories. And we have an intellectual property manager on our side here in Singapore. And then once or twice a week, I'll go over to Malaysia. It's actually only an hour and a half, kind of door to door, and visit the production facility where we have a larger research team. So I have about 17 staff there in Malaysia that are split across three teams. They work on a bioconversion. There's one team. It's a feed formulation nutrition for the larvae, kind of inputs to outputs, getting good biological conversion of our raw materials. And then there's a team that looks at the broodstock system, general entomology. And there's also kind of a nice creative engineering component that happens within that. We have a few 3D printers and do some neat kind of internal product development work there. And then we have a biotech team. So we actually have a dedicated microbiology facility with access to up to 1,000-liter bioreactor. So it's a really spectacular kind of level of, wow, of industrial fermentation access. So we can do a lot of really cool things with just interrogating the insect, the black soldier fly microbiome, and discovering everything it can offer. And we're really at the tip of the iceberg. We already have kind of two microbial inoculant outcomes from that process, but there's a whole lot more in the works. So yeah, I spend a lot of time on product development and strategy. I also work kind of an advocating for our industry in the region. So I've been organizing a really big conference here in Singapore called Insects to Feed the World. So I'll be in Singapore in June 19th, the 22nd, 2024. Be about 500-600 people from the industry all kind of converging on Singapore. So it'll be a really exciting time and a really nice opportunity to showcase Southeast Asia's insect sector.
Wow. So I'm giving you a magic wand. What is the one thing that you would change today that could have an impact?
Yeah, I think for me, I would really change. I would stop producing feed from land and ocean resources. Like, I do often just think about the amount of resources we put into these feed systems. And I think just like stopping doing that would be just such an enormous benefit. I often think of it in terms of like in the 18th century, we used to think that hunting whales for oil to light our homes was like a normal thing. Like, mm-hmm, that was like an accepted, like, yeah, that's how my home is lit, is whale oil, you know? And now we look back at that, like, that was crazy. Like, that, you know, there were so many other better ways of doing it. I think the same about a lot of food production systems, but especially animal feed. I don't think we arrived at where we are with any sort of logic. I think we just got really good at producing human grade food like corn and soybeans. And we produced a lot of them. And we said, hey, let's feed these to animals too. And that just took us where we are now, which is if you talk about agriculture, we're mainly talking about animal feed. Like if aliens came in, zoomed into Earth, right, and looked around, they say, well, as far as agriculture, this species mainly farms food for their animals, right? Human agriculture is smaller than the agriculture we devote to animals, which is just crazy. So I think that's really the number one thing I would push for and really change about the food system that we have now.
Especially with a growing population. I mean, everybody talks about a growing population and how do we feed 10 million people? Well,
yeah, and climate change, like the drought impacts that we're going to have across, I mean, it's large land areas, but they're relatively concentrated in North America and the Americas. And, you know, they're very susceptible to droughts. There could be devastating, you know, loss of food resources due to climate impacts that we don't think about, partially because, again, like, we just don't think about animal feed that much. But they're already happening. They're very real. This year has really roiled the animal feed commodities market and caused a lot of disruption.
Yeah, let's talk about that a little bit. I mean, where I live, last year it was all drought. This year is all floods. farmers are at a loss. Everything is more expensive. And obviously, it's our doing, right, with climate. So what's your take on possible actions, solutions? Where should we go? If you were talking to a government, if you were talking to the lobbies, what would you say?
Yeah, I think, in our part of the world in particular, and again, like regional context dependency is important. In our part of the world, it's become such a clear issue after the COVID-19 pandemic. The governments of Singapore and Malaysia were already very worried about kind of relying too much on product imports. And then what happened was the war in Ukraine plus some drought and supply chain issues. We had this one particular moment where chicken prices in Malaysia spiked because of imported feed ingredients were so expensive. And you have to keep in mind, being in Asia, Southeast Asia in particular basically produces negligible amounts of animal feed. Most of Southeast Asian farmers are smallholders. There's not that much land, high population. So they're just really never going to produce like the big soybean fields of North America or Brazil or Argentina. So these places, some farmers rely on feed ingredients that are 70% imported, right? So whenever there's a disruption, it's actually felt a lot worse in Asia than a lot of places. And you had this whole crisis and Malaysia stopped exporting chicken to Singapore to try to control prices. And then Singapore got really upset because chicken is a really important part of national dishes. And a lot of pressure all of a sudden to say, wait a minute, these big climate disruptions, these big food supply chain disruptions can be so damaging. And here we are relying on products shipped from very far away. So if something happens way over there in the coast of Peru or in North America or in Ukraine, right, we who import 70% of the materials, we're most susceptible to feeling that pain. We're at the bottom of the pecking order all of a sudden. So yeah, places like Malaysia have done a good job recently of really asking deep questions about what can we produce locally, right? And it's just starting, and I'm optimistic that we can get some good support on some of the local feed solutions. But I think kind of thinking carefully about where your place is in the, especially in the animal feed side, like where your place is in that global system, is really important, because chances are you're not a producer, in which case you really have to start thinking about, for you and your geography, your climate, like what can you produce on your land that is sustainable, because more of these supply chain shocks are coming through climate change. For sure, they're coming.
Absolutely. And for someone that lived in South America like yourself, I mean, one of the questions that is often asked is, this is my business. I produce animal feed, and I do it from, soy. I'll be at a loss if all of a sudden I need to change, right? Like, my business has been going on like this forever. My answer is always like, you need to diversify, you need to do things different and still make money so that you are not at a loss. But for someone that lived in that side of the world, what's your take on that? And how do we help these industries that have always done things one way to do things differently, basically?
Yeah, I mean, farmers everywhere in the world get the short end of the stick, right? And one of the primary issues is when you sell a commodities product, all the value gets added later on in the process, and you just get such a tiny fraction of the value add. So the incentive really isn't there for you to do anything. But also, you just can't. A lot of times you have no space. Yeah, I'm most familiar with coffee because my family farms a little bit of coffee, and that's definitely the case in coffee. So I think, honestly, like, rather than sort of saying we can do this or that to convince farmers to change something, we need to really look at how the food system creates the right economic incentive for farmers. That's, I think, a fundamental approach. And whenever farmers can move away from commoditized markets into quality markets or into just economic systems, whether they're local or international, that don't require, don't don't follow internationally traded commodity pricing, they tend to be a lot more opportunities. And I think fundamentally, like whether it's Malaysia or Ecuador, most farmers want to change. I think most farmers prefer not to use chemicals and prefer not to use the cheapest, low quality feed ingredient. Often they just can't. So I think it's up to us and the rest of the food supply chain to support farmers.
Yes, and they are extremely important if we actually want to do something about climate change. We cannot forget about farmers. So a couple more questions as we are almost out of time. So you started with insects, black soldier flies. What's next?
So, yeah, I think we often get put in a box around the insect that we use or the approach that we take, and people assume that the future for us and our company all involves just scaling that same system. But the way we see what we do is really around this framework of decomposition, right? Where we're finally leveraging this very powerful biological system that evolved over time to transform waste mass material into more usable forms within a trophic system. So in that sense, we see the growth and development of our industry and our company in the context of not necessarily focusing on what a single species can do. Like already within our system, we're growing insects, but we're also fermenting all of our feedstocks. So we're really working a lot with microbiology. And we see that as really the future of the black soldier fly industry in many ways, is to deeply understand microbial symbionts and how to effectively process organic matter in efficient ways through multiple kind of stages, through leveraging these decomposing microorganisms. So we want to grow that a lot. We also really want to grow all the range of what we produce, right? So insects don't only produce protein, right? You imagine the same in fermentation, right? Like, you know, the initial uses of fermentation were straightforward, things like alcohol. And now through fermentation, we can produce bioplastics and medicine, and anything you can imagine can be produced through fermentation. I think the same is true of insects over time. We will be able to kind of understand their biology deep enough that we'll be able to create solutions that right now people don't really even associate at all with insects. So I'm really excited for that future and to expand the horizon of what we're working on.
Well, I wish you good luck on that. And how can people get in touch with you or learn more about what you do?
Yeah. So our company, you can look up our company. It's called Nutrition Technologies. You can Google it and throw in like insects or black soldier flies if you have trouble. You can also reach out to me on LinkedIn, Martin Zaria. You should be able to find me there. And yeah, feel free to reach out. We're always happy to chat or collaborate across distinct fields.
Super cool. And good luck to you, Martin.
Thanks very much, Sharon.
Want to dive deep into food innovation? Subscribe to the Food Tech Junkie series. Tune in and listen to the industry's champions whose mission is to reinvent our future by collaborating and disrupting the status quo as a way to rebalance our planet in our daily lives. For more great content, visit our website at www.edibleplanetventures.com and follow us on social media on the Edible Planet Ventures channels.